Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, starting the day today by talking about how the class of weight loss drugs, including, let's see, Ozempic is one, Wegovy another one. Those are two that anytime I turn on the television, I hear ads for Ozempic and Wegovy, and there are some other ones as well. But these drugs can lower your risk for heart attacks. And we'll talk about that today with Dr. Maya Safarova, a cardiologist with Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Maybe you're struggling with your weight, wondering about your cardiovascular health, perhaps. Are you a good candidate for GLP-1 medication? Maybe you're already on it. Love to hear your comments about that as well. Give a call, the number 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Safarova, thank you very much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry, for having me. I'm excited to be here to talk about this incredibly important topic.
Well, these drugs, and Ozempic and Wegovy are just two. I think there are at least a couple of others. How do they work in the system? What are they doing?
Yeah, that's always good to know. What are we starting with? So this is a glucagon-like peptide type 1, or GLP-1 agonist. That's what the abbreviation that we typically hear. And GLP-1 is a hormone that all of us, we produce in the gut. And what it does, it regulates blood sugar and appetite. What these medications do, they mimic this hormone, and initially they were of particular interest for the treatment of type 2 diabetes, and then it came to obesity. What happens when these medications are used is that there's insulin release that is being stimulated, there's slowing of the digestion, and as a result, there's increase in satiety or increase in the feeling of fullness. You mentioned some of popular brand names, and we'll talk more about Ozempic, Wegovy, Zepbound. They all are going under this umbrella of nutrient-stimulated hormones. So there's this term, nutrient-stimulated hormone, and GLP-1 is one of the FDA, or Food and Drug Administration, approved therapeutic targets. So, for instance, Ozempic or semaglutide and liraglutide are GLP-1 receptor agonists. But there's also GLP-1 and GIP receptor agonist. GIP stands for glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, or GIP. So these combination drugs, this is tirzepatide, and for instance, Zepbound is one of those examples. So that's something that we produce, and these medications, they mimic what we produce.
I was looking at the numbers on this, and I last fall, I think there were more than 30 million people taking this medication for weight loss. Were you surprised by the popularity of these drugs?
No, not at all. You know, we talk about epidemic of obesity, not just in the United States. It's a global epidemic. It's a global problem, and it's a problem that affects public health, affects individual. It's also costly. And I think there was an analysis. One that comes to my mind was presented in 2018. If you were to put a price tag on obesity, it's a $1.7 trillion. Endeavor.
Wow.
So it's a very expensive condition to have. You know, what's interesting, it's actually when you think about obesity, if you look at the data, it continues to increase in terms of the prevalence and incidence. And this is despite the fact that over the past, let's say, two decades, based on the more recent data, there was not significant change in the caloric intake or the physical activity levels. So there was at some point this decrease in physical activity. The trends were going down for both females and for women and men. And then there was more of a caloric intake, but now it's sort of fairly steady. But despite that steadiness, despite no significant change over the past 20 years, there's increase in obesity, which makes you question of what has changed.
What the heck's going on?
Exactly. That's one of the interesting research questions. And one of the things that our research is focused is using genomics and genetics as well as epigenetics tools to better understand arterial and vascular aging. But that's also interesting for obesity. It's like you have a set of genes when you're born, and there's certain expectation of how they will express. And that's how we develop certain conditions that are more or less genetically predisposed. What we've also learned through epigenetics is that there are external mechanisms that can turn on some genes and turn them off. And what it's been observed is that some of the environmental factors, some of the stressors, some of the chemicals, including some of the foods, they actually result in turning on the genes that are involved in metabolic pathways associated with slowing the metabolism and turning off the ones that are more associated with faster metabolism. So it's not only, simply saying being lazy and not eating healthy, which is regardless very important, food is medicine, but there are additional parameters that contribute to us seeing obesity on its rise. And as a result, cardiovascular disease.
Yeah. You know, I've done shows on weight loss, and once a long time ago, I even did a exercise weight loss set of programs on this show where I needed to lose some weight, and I invited listeners to join me. Part of the conversation we get in this is that there are people who say, I don't eat a lot. I exercise a ton, and I can't get a pound off. And I can't, I wind up gaining weight. And there's so much among those folks, there is a lot of frustration and sort of anger because of the way they are sometimes treated.
Yeah, that's what I see in my clinic as well. I'm part of the cardiovascular prevention program, and frequently we talk about how to optimize cardiovascular health and body mass index, or BMI. That's current measure of how we identify someone who's overweight and someone who has obesity, which we can talk about has its limitations. But there frequently you hear frustrations from people who do their best. They're trying to eat salads, more greens. They're watching what is their saturated fat. They're trying to go to gym, and they're trying, in other words, their best. And, just to use this time and emphasize that American Heart Association recommends about 150, and more recent data, 200 minutes per week of physical activity, which is about 40, 45 minutes a day, five times a week. It could be longer stretches if, for instance, your work schedule doesn't allow you, that you would do like a weekend warrior. That all has substantial cardiovascular benefits, and goes without saying, even if you are not able to lose your weight, still continue doing that, because long-term this commitment does improve your vascular aging processes. It's not only about the number of that, what BMI looks like, but also trying to have that healthy BMI with reduced number of cardiovascular events. And if you are following that right diet and physical activity routine, you are on the right track. But you're so right that there's a lot of frustration when people come and they say that, the whole year I've been working on and working out, and I'm still not really moving. There's not significant change. Sometimes there's still room to improve. Sometimes it's good to talk with a dietitian, with a nutritionist, with someone who can provide a little bit of an input and be a little bit more personalized. But what I think where we're going with a lot of discoveries in the future, you know, with transcriptomics and proteomics, is that it will be more personalized in terms of to your metabolism, because there's, in a way, common denominator of what we recommend, right? We recommend usually two dietary patterns, such as Mediterranean diet, that's been shown in a randomized clinical trial to improve cardiovascular outcomes, saturated with olive oil, it is enriched with nuts, fish, fruits and vegetables, and another one is plant-based diet that's been shown to also have a number of positive clinical outcomes, including in the cancer world. We are not necessarily individualizing those approaches. It's fairly generalized if you think about it. And it's not necessarily ideal because everyone's metabolism is different. And the way that we process eggs, let's say, I'm seeing patients in my lipid clinic who have high cholesterol. And they frequently ask, well, what should I do with eggs? How many eggs should I take? Or should I just stop? Because there was all this notion that you shouldn't be having any egg yolks and no butter. Or maybe now it's okay to have it. So there are a lot of questions usually. And you give the recommendations based on your best knowledge, but it's not necessarily individualized based on how your body operates. And I think that's where we're heading to learn more about how our body operates.
You mentioned a body mass index of 30 or 27 to 30. And I think that's when people become eligible for that GLP-1. If they have a what is a body mass index of 30? I mean, how's that measured? What does it look like?
Yeah, it's simply the calculator is just your height and weight. So anyone can do it at home, knowing your it's a ratio and it's easy to estimate. Usually you need to use kilos and meters instead of pounds and inches. So that's the only caveat. otherwise, yes, for like you've been mentioning, 30 kilograms per meter squared, BMI above that threshold is considered to be obesity for adults based on WHO, World Health Organization, and then overweight is considered to be above 27. And, you know, if you look at the risk curves in terms of cardiovascular disease, there's fluctuation. It does gradually increase starting at around BMI of 25, then going further 27 and 30 and above. So there's association with your weight and with the cardiovascular outcomes.
Talking today with Dr. Maya Safarova, cardiologist with Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. We're taking a look at weight loss, protecting your heart. We're looking at some of the GLP medications, like Wegovy and Ozempic, that are in use, and taking a look at what are the upsides and maybe what are some of the potential downsides to taking these drugs. Maybe you're taking one right now, or maybe you wish you could take one. Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking with Dr. Maya Safarova, a cardiologist with Froedtert of the Medical College of Wisconsin. Great to have her with us as we talk about these GLP medications, weight loss, your heart, and hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along. I did want to mention the GLP drugs now have become available in pill form, and previously, of course, the medications were home-administered injections. And how do you think this pill form will affect how many people maybe seek out these medications?
Yeah, when it comes to a choice, injectable or a pill, it's certainly, I would say, vast majority will say that having a pill is more appealing, just that you don't need to think about administering. But as of now, for this class of medications, I would say the bioavailability for injectables is much better. It's close to 100% as compared to pill form, when you need to have a higher concentration When you look at them head to head in terms of comparison, you see more prominent hemoglobin A1C or glycated hemoglobin, which is a measure of glucose metabolism over the course of 2 to 3 months, reduction in that parameter. So you have better glucose control. And importantly, you have more predictable and better weight loss. And it's more substantial as compared to the pill form as of now. It might change, but as of now, I would say that when I have those conversations, just focusing on what type of medications we should be choosing, injectables would be probably prioritized compared to the pill form. The pill form, the example would be Rybelsus, as you know, that was approved for type 2 diabetes in 2019. So it's been, and in general, these medications, by the way, I think that's one of the myths that they're still experimental. They've been out there for quite some time, and clinical trials, phase 3 clinical trials have been out for a decade, 2016, actually 2026, we're celebrating 10 years of having outcome data for these medications. But with pills, I think another important, clinically important aspect is that you have to be fairly strict with timing. So you take it at around the same time in the morning, and you have to be fasting, and then you take your meal about 30 minutes afterwards. So it's also fairly particular about how you take it compared to the injectable.
Well, and you know, mostly we hear about it in these drugs and medications in relation to weight loss right now, but it also. I mean, they were originally designed for something else, weren't they?
Yeah, that's correct. They were for type 2 diabetes. That was the intention. And that makes sense because that's GLP-1 receptor agonist. That's what they are intended to do. But what we've learned, and we continue to learn, there's actually a lot of ongoing research and still a lot of ongoing interest in this class. And again, that's a nutrient-stimulated hormones. The GLP-1 receptors express quite widely in our body. That includes kidneys. And that's why we see some kidney outcome data. That includes vessels. That's why it's interesting from standpoint of arterial aging. That includes heart. And that's particular of interest to cardiologists. And that's how cardiologists are now into this, discussing this class of medications in order to improve cardiometabolic health. And initially, trials were focusing on patients with established cardiovascular disease, for instance, someone who had a heart attack, acute coronary syndrome, and type 2 diabetes. And then as the signal was showing that, oh, there's benefit also in those who don't have type 2 diabetes, so there are additional, if you will, pleiotropic effects, effects that we were not expecting from these medications. There were more trials and trials that were focusing on those with established atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, heart attacks and strokes, without diabetes, and then those who are at risk for heart disease. So even wider patient category, wider category of those who would be eligible to derive benefits from this class of medications.
Yeah. Well, if you're overweight and you take Ozempic, let's say, and you lose a significant amount of weight, my guess would be that's going to lower or decrease your risk of heart disease.
Yes. So weight reduction, very true, Larry, very true. Weight reduction, granted, you know, we talked about BMI being sort of flawed, because the height and weight description does not really tell you, is it your muscle weight? Is it your visceral fat? So what we are mostly hoping to see is visceral fat reduction as part of the overall orchestra of how we are reducing cardiovascular risk. Through that mechanism, including other metabolic pathways, I would say that the current average statistics, what we're seeing is reduction in heart attacks, for instance, that could be non-fatal heart attacks by about 10%, reduction in cardiovascular death by about 15%, heart failure reduction by about up to 20%. I think one of the kidney outcome is reduction in kidney outcome data by about 15 to 18%. But what I find interesting is that these medications were also showing to reduce all-cause mortality. In some of the trials, it was up to 20%, 19%, wow. which just overall suggests, like, what would be your interpretation, that they improve your overall health. It's quite hard. There are not a lot of interventions that can improve and reduce your overall all-cause mortality. That's quite impressive.
Well, we have we had some phone problems earlier, but they're resolved now. We have a number of people to visit with you. Let's go to Julie in Minocqua first. Julie, hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I'm calling on behalf of my husband, who has a hearing deficit. He has, and we're actually patients at Cratered, and have been trying to get qualified for the Ozempic class drugs for quite a while. His body mass index is 39. He's pre-diabetic. He has mild COPD and sleep apnea. But for some reason, it seems because he's not diabetic that he doesn't qualify. And we're just struggling with
That.
Okay. Yeah.
Julie, thanks a lot for calling. It raises an interesting point here.
Yeah, Julie, thank you for your question and thank you for calling. Thank you for being seen at Fratert. You know, that is unfortunately a struggle indeed, and I cannot tell you how frequently we have to write letters of medical necessity, how frequently. So these medications, as you know, they don't have generics. They have to go through a process called prior authorization. As of now, that's how in our healthcare system we get insurance to cover. There's always a pathway of out of pocket, which is incredibly costly and hard to reach. But with to get insurance approval, it does take a lot of effort. I must note that it's been a little easier, maybe more recently. I think with my patients, when I see them, we can have initial maybe not positive outcome. We appeal, we try a different one. We try to see what is on the plan. We try to see what else can be added in terms of the description of the clinical scenario. We try to have peer-to-peer conversation. So it over time, I feel like it will get better and better. If you think about particularly, I think you mentioned Zepbound, right? That's what you were working on, tirzepatide. So tirzepatide for the indication of obstructive sleep apnea, moderate to severe, that's now an indication, an individual who has elevated BMI in the range of obesity has been approved by the FDA in 2024. There's frequently a lag between how easy it is to get insurance approval, how fast they get on the plan from the time that FDA approves it. And it does require a lot of push from the care team. And even sometimes with a push, it doesn't. It's strange that you have to talk about it, that you have to have your physicians and healthcare team to push for something when something is indicated. And, you know, we're singing songs about how great they are in our armamentarium to have to reduce cardiovascular outcomes. But it is a challenge. It is a true challenge. And I know that a lot of physicians would just give up and say that, you know, that's just not feasible. You can't spend so much time on the phone, like in 30 minutes, an hour, just trying to convince someone that this is the right patient, like for weight management, for instance, and that will really improve their cardiovascular health, that will help with their knee problems. They might not need an expensive knee surgery, as an example, and overall they will be more physically active. And there are a lot of struggle there. And I think what I would wish, Julie, is that just maintain patience and perseverance and keep working in that direction with the team. You know, if they have challenges, we are certainly happy to see you in our clinic and go over more in details of what can be done. But Zepbound is one. And just to mention, Larry, I know you have another question. There's also Mounjaro. So there are a number of medications we should at some point just discuss to make sure that our listeners know. The most frequent one, you know, we talked about Ozempic. There's also liraglutide. But depending on the indications, for instance, Ozempic has been approved for type 2 diabetes since 2017. When we talk about semaglutide for the indication of weight loss, one has to recognize that's a different concentration also in terms of the medication. So for the weight loss, it is Wegovy, and it's been approved since 2021. Wegovy now is approved also for cardiovascular risk reduction, some of the providers may want to have that from the FDA webpage. They have a nice description of who's eligible. Sometimes I add clinical trial data to my notes to just sort of like supportive evidence of why we're talking about Wegovy. This has been approved since March 2024, actually March 8th, 2024, almost exactly 2 years. Now, more recently, in patients who have been diagnosed with quote-unquote fatty liver disease or recent appropriate diagnosis is metabolic-associated liver disease or MAFLD or MASH, it's been approved since August 2025. So even in this patient population, Wegovy could be used. So Wegovy and Ozempic, these are the two when it comes to semaglutide. For tirzepatide, which is a combination drug, GLP-1, remember we talked at the beginning, and GIP. So the Zepbound has been approved as a chronic weight management medication in 2023 when there are additional risk factors, and that could be, for instance, you have elevated blood pressure or you have elevated cholesterol. And then since 2024, Zepbound, as I mentioned, approved for obstructive sleep apnea. Now, the second medication that also has a tirzepatide as its main active ingredient is Mounjaro. And Mounjaro has been approved for glucose metabolism or sugar management in type 2 diabetes.
You know, I was looking at some of the figures this morning some of the cost, let's put it that way. So there was one GLP-1 medication that, for insurance purposes, it was like at around $1,300 a month. But then I noted also, if you paid out of your own pocket, it was $300 to $500 a month. And I thought, why the heck isn't the insurance side of it at, I understand there's paperwork and all of that, but that's a like $800 difference. That doesn't make any, well, it makes sense if you got stock in the company, that's for sure. And I believe me, I wish I had bought stock in Wegovy and Ozempic about 20 years ago or 10 years ago even. I don't understand how there can be an $800 difference or more between paying it out of your own pocket, which, believe me, $300 to $500 a month is no small amount. But why is it $1,300 versus $500?
Oh, Larry. Well, full disclosure, I also don't have any stocks. And, mostly what I do is really research, translating research into clinical practice. And I wish I had an answer. It just beyond, I'm more at the front line of implementing rather than making policies. And I think what we lack is transparency in understanding how those costs are being made. And end users, as providers, and those who use them for indications, I think that advocacy at the state level, moving further to federal level, is something that is urgently needed. Yeah. You know, we identify the problem. We know that there is epidemic. We know that there is a gap in management. We understand that this is not just being lazy and hungry and snacking. We understand that there is more in-depth problems. But that the pricing aspect related, and it's not only GLP-1 problem, it just may be more recognized because they're widely used or widely there's more interest in, because I see in my clinic a spectrum of individuals who are coming, spectrum of enthusiasm. There are those who are coming and they really know what they need, what they want. And then those who are very hesitant to start, and there are aspects like why they are hesitant. But that is true for imaging. That is true for other medications, that there's a gap between what is being billed to insurance and gap between what you might be paying out of pocket. But the price that you were mentioning today, for instance, it's still much better than it was a few years ago. Our institution was among early adopters of GLP-1s. And I remember times when days when it was above 1800. And, you know, the seeing that the cost is coming down is already sort of making you feel better, but I just don't have a good answer. And I think talking about it, the fact that we're talking about it and raising awareness, maybe it will reach ears of those who are policymakers and realize how important it is. Maybe it will be, this will be something that will generate and add to conversation at a level where the decisions are actually made, and that patients will have access to treatments that are, you know, I'm going to use the word of life-saving treatments.
Let's take some, Julie, again, thank you for calling, Julie. Eric in Middleton has been waiting a bit. Eric, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thank you. Yeah, I have a decision to make about going on Ozempic. I have type 2 diabetes. My BMI is about 29. I weight train and do not present as obese because of that. I probably could lose about 12 pounds, but what should I consider when making a decision about going on Ozempic? And I'm thinking about the negatives. I've heard about a loss of muscle mass and a loss of motivation to exercise.
Yeah.
What
good.
Should I consider?
Good question, Eric. What about it, Dr. Safarova?
That's awesome, Eric. Thank you. I'm glad you're opening up, because it's the whole box of Pandora. I think, you know, I mentioned earlier that there's a spectrum of individuals who, a spectrum of enthusiasm who come, who know what and how, and those who sort of are more, okay, tell me more about why we should be thinking about it. And, you know, I'm going to start with, for semaglutide, for instance, contraindications. It's important to know the range of situations where you shouldn't be thinking about these medications. So personal or family history, personal family history of so-called medullary thyroid carcinoma. So those who have thyroid cancer would have issues on this medication, negative outcomes. So that's why this takes away Ozempic. There's a condition called MED2. It's fairly rare, but it's important to make sure that an individual doesn't have a MED2. MED2 stands for multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome, type 2. And then there's certainly those who have allergies to semaglutide, which you won't discover up until you have the medication. But I would say those two, I want to take it right away. They are fairly rare, but if it is something to be considered, especially if there's family history, no, personal history should be still considered. Now, then you take it to the next level and you think, okay, what are the indications? The indications we talked about, managing the weight and expectations. It's a long-term treatment. It's a commitment. That's another actually topic in terms of how to come out, if it's possible to come out, what is the data in terms of trying to wean off, how long can we do it, just for half a year and stop, or you will regain weight. At present, when you start, you're thinking about long-term commitment. Long-term commitment to something that's injectable and having a certain level of comfort to administer. For instance, a person who has significant tremors, that might be a challenge. So one has to look for someone who will administer. Granted, it's easy to administer. Usually, if we're talking about FDA-approved formulations, they're coming as a pen. So it's not a vial that you need to pull and inject. It's a pen, and it's fairly straightforward to inject. There's site injection reaction, which is what is typically seen with any injectable medication, including for the medications that are cholesterol management. And then there are also a component of you know, you hear a lot of success stories of individuals starting on a medication, tolerating it fairly well, and losing weight that is predominantly visceral weight of 80 pounds plus minus. But there are also individuals who are not able to tolerate one or another formulation because of the so-called gastrointestinal symptoms. And nausea and vomiting are not trivial. I do have some patients who tell me that, you know what, I will maintain, but I know that when I give myself an injection, that 24 to 48 hours, I'm not necessarily a very functional individual. It also depends on your work of line. You know, there's some people for whom it's very important to be focused and there's just no opportunity for them to negotiate it. You can always plan on the weekend or whatever the day off you have. But I think when you start, that's also important to keep in mind that one can develop those side effects. Diarrhea. And if you look at the clinical trial data, for instance, the most, one of the, well, maybe it has been updated, but in 2023, there was a New England Journal paper on the trial was SELECT trial and was looking into individuals with cardiovascular risk without diabetes. GI side effects were the leading ones. Otherwise, in comparison to placebo, there was no significant signal so far that makes us concerned. They've been out there for quite some time. One has still to remain vigilant when it comes to the patient and to the physician. We're still talking about maybe one generation, 20 years, maybe more than 20 years, but about one up to generation of individuals who are being treated. So there's still data to be accumulated, and one has to keep an open mind and register any potential hints that are concerning. But I would say that there are ways for an individual, I also want to mention that for our listeners, through the FDA website to report side effects, not just through your physician. You certainly have to notify the prescriber, but to notify about the side effects. And that's one of the critical differentiating aspects probably with the compounded drug. As you know, there's also a compounded option. That compounded options are not being overseen, so the efficacy safety is always questionable. There's a BeSafe Rx website, which is a good source for online pharmacy information and also can guide you in some of those questions related to side effects. So I would say that one of the major aspects would be knowing that this is a long-term treatment, knowing that the timing when you take the medication in comparison to the food intake, modifying your diet if appropriate in terms of how I would say greasy it is, the content of that meal that you take the day of injection is important. And you also mentioned an important component of muscle loss. So there is currently understanding that some individuals lose not only visceral fat, but also muscle. And I think there's ongoing work in this direction. There was just recently this year a publication that came on phase two clinical trial. It was published in Nature. The medication is called Bimagrumab. Bimagrumab is it's an antibody that targets type 2 activin receptor. And this study particular, in a small number of patients, was randomized clinical trial, but it was a small number of patients. When they combined this Bimagrumab, with semaglutide and versus monotherapy semaglutide. And they were shown that they showed that there is a substantial reduction in body weight, and the muscle weight was not necessarily affected. So there are ways how in the future we'll be able to overcome, and it's very closely coming, but it's true that one has to monitor it. And in clinical practice, unfortunately, we're not as good in identifying that visceral fat. There are ways how with the CAT scan, you can measure it actually physically. Mostly what you will see in the doctor's office, there's measurement of the neck circumference and then the waist circumference, in addition to BMI, body mass index. But it's not the best way how we would identify that differentiate visceral fat. I think with better technology, we'll be also better at monitoring and having that surveillance.
Yeah. So, and Eric's a weightlifter, so there's that. I think there some of the information you provide, well, all of it, but that in particular might have perked his interest a bit with the other pills. Thank you again, Eric. Dot in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Dot. Oh, I think we lost Dot. Well, in that case, a quick reminder here, we're talking with Dr. Maya Safarova, cardiologist with Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Maya Safarova, cardiologist with Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin, as we look at the GLP-1 medications for weight loss and probably relating to heart as well. And Denise in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Larry and doctor. My question has to do with the relationship or use of these medications in children. There has been, as we all know, a rise in childhood obesity over the last however many years. And, have there been any clinical trials? Is there any indication for their use? And at what point in time do pediatricians start looking at something like a BMI for children?
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Denise.
Yeah, Denise, thank you for this question. And, overall, I think our goal in cardiovascular prevention and in general in preventive world should be switched to more focusing on actually youth, because that's where we gain the most benefit. If we address risk factors, we talk about family history and possibility of disease development early in life. Body mass index being one of those measurements that allows to identify those at risk. Now, my disclosure is that I'm an adult cardiologist, but what I can share in the pediatric world is that GLP-1 receptor agonists such as liraglutide and semaglutide have been approved for children age 12 years and above. Type 2 diabetes established is one of the indications which as many of you might know, might not manifest as early as 12 years old, and usually maybe doesn't. And then those with elevated BMI. So they're FDA approved. Now, I know for pediatricians, it is always a challenge to consider initiation of pharmacotherapies in young individuals for risk factor control, including for cholesterol, just because you are thinking that this is more towards adult world. I think more data and awareness is what will help. We just talked that it's not only about the diet and not only about physical activity, which goes without saying. It's important to implement. It's important to be focused. And the causes of obesity are versatile, from including genetics. But at some point, you I think having maybe more data saying that intervening early is beneficial is what will convince a wider range of pediatrician to implement it. Like example would be with cholesterol. The recommendation currently is for screening 9 to 11 years that you would do your cholesterol screening. And depending on the situation, start therapies at the age of 8 years old, for instance, depending on the situation and genetics, could be early, could be later. But that in the world of cholesterol, we have data that shows long-term over more than two generations that early initiations of cholesterol treatment reduces your risk of heart attacks, strokes, need for stents and bypass surgery. I think that's what we need in the pediatric world of managing diabetes and obesity. And that there's still the data is limited on the long-term effects of these drugs on bone growth and hormone levels and puberty. And this is probably the main concern that my colleagues would bring. I think maybe at some point bringing a pediatrician on board and would be interesting to have that debate and just interesting to know what they would opt, like bariatric surgery versus pharmacological therapy versus non-pharmacological interventions and when they would intervene on that curve. For me, they come and see me usually starting at the age of 20. Sometimes it's 18 years of age, depending on the pathology, but mostly it's 20 years old. And at that age, it's easier to have this conversation without necessarily taking into account additional questions of their development.
Yeah. Denise, thank you. Margaret has a daughter who is at least 100 pounds overweight. Now, this may be an older daughter. I'm not sure. She is disabled and on Medicaid. Are there any programs or ways for her to get the medication for free or reduce cost?
Yes, there's actually there are grants. And in our institution, every institution has their own program in terms of how they set it up. I can speak for our institution. Our program involves pharmacists. There's a provider, there's a physician with knowledge of indications, contraindications, how to manage. There's a dietitian, and there's a pharmacist. And we work closely together, trying to identify ways how to increase accessibility. You know, we spent quite some time today, I think, talking about the issues with the access. But for certain individuals, there are ways how we help them to get so-called grant support when for a period of time they will be getting certain medications for it's not free, certainly. I don't think there's, unfortunately, in this world anything free, but it's through mechanisms where we're supporting them that they would be able to start. And then further, depending on the situation with maintenance, could be renewed or there are other ways. But the answer is yes, there are ways, and it's all individual, depends on income, depends on clinical scenario and situation. And my hope is that, again, there will be more ways how on the state level we will increase the accessibility to both these programs as well as to medications.
Ellie in Madison had emailed us and wonders, she's noticed that the people in the GLP commercials are getting skinnier and is afraid that the prevalence, is harming body image, especially for young girls. In the last 30 seconds, a comment on that?
Gosh, that's not a 30-second conversation, the body image. That is, you know, the interpretation, and it certainly has to be part of the conversation, especially with younger individuals during your visit with a doctor. I think the commercials don't really take into account that aspect. They're more trying to leverage more interest. But when you have that conversation with a doctor, it's important to go over the details. And I agree. That is raising a whole another issue of mental health.
Well, Dr. Safarova, I thank you so much. Will you come back and be with us again? I'd love to have you back. We haven't covered everything that I wanted to cover.
Thank you. I would love to. And I would love you to talk about cholesterol. If there's any interest among listeners about lipoprotein(a), about genetic cholesterol, I think there's so much to cover. And it's just an ability to talk through things and increase awareness is, to me, is one of the rewarding aspects of our job. And
thank you very much, Dr. Maya Safarova, cardiologist with Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Coming up next, Dr. Zorba Pastor, our guest.